So then we are continuing in Revelation, the seventh chapter, and our particular verse of picking up is verse 2.
Excuse me, Rick? Can I have, can you let me record?
I can. No
Thank
problem.
You.
Okay. Does anyone else want to record that I'm not getting? Okay. So then what we would like to do is, Sister Debbie, are you able to read this morning? Please read Revelation 7, verses 1 through 4, please.
Okay. And after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel.
All right, thank you. Let me just start by saying, does anyone have initial comments that they have a burning desire to express? We're happy to entertain it. Sister Molly.
I was thinking about the seal in the forehead, and Exodus came to mind with the high priest having the plate on the forehead, the gold plate with the blue cord, and that it read holy to the Lord. And I just was thinking as a picture of the royal priesthood and also having that seal. It's not the same probably as a seal, but just thinking of it in those terms as a symbol of the royal priesthood spiritually. Over.
Yes, indeed. No, we appreciate that. Yeah, there's actually, since you bring that up, there's a number of different scriptural pictures and examples of something being on the forehead, either good or bad, because one can also receive the mark of the beast in the forehead or in the hand. And we remember with the phylacteries, it was the word of God was supposed to be remembered in the forehead and in the hand. And some of the pious Jews do that literally. And then we also have known from our studies that in Revelation, the 14th chapter, verses 1, we have the 144,000 standing on Mount Zion with the name of their Father and of the Lord Jesus in their forehead, being, as it were, a family name. And that high priest with the golden plate, showing the divine authority that he has in his forehead, holiness to the Lord, which was the work that the high priest was to complete. And how fitting that was, a picture of Jesus as our high priest of our profession, Hebrews 3:1. So, yes, it absolutely demonstrates that the Lord is using the forehead in several fashions. A simplistic way is, of course, it's first and foremost, when you look at somebody, you look at their face and you would notice something on the forehead, so it's predominant. But it also, as we know, represents the intellectual acknowledgement of either that which is good and right or that which is wrong, like the mark of the beast. So here, this sealing in particular has this, Brother Russell brings out, it has the thought of a crystallization of character with the intellectual understanding of God's truth. And only 144,000 received this seal. So it's not just hearing the truth. It's not just having an understanding of truth, but rather only 144,000 receiving it. It shows that it is taking that truth and allowing it to have the intended effect of developing a godlike, Christ-like character. That's what knowledge is what knowledge is supposed to accomplish in anyone who ever receives the truth, the true knowledge. So it's supposed to guide one toward God and Jesus particularly in their characters. So it's not enough to know the truth, if one knows the truth, but has, not crystallized their character and righteousness, it hasn't had the intended effect. All right. So, comments on that. All right. Ruth and then, Sister Debbie and Brother Chris.
It was also along the same line that Molly was thinking in Revelation 14. It reminded me of that. Can I read it for the first few verses?
Sure.
And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, with him 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. Just that they had the harmony. They're the ones that could harmonize the character and the intellectual understanding of the truth together. They're the only ones that had the exact balance for it. Over.
Yep. Okay, very good. So true. Sister Debbie.
You know, I just seem to notice, it seems like everybody gets some kind of seal at some point or another. You know, if you're not sealed with the seal of the living God, then you're sealed with the seal of Babylon. I mean, even the Gray Company eventually gets sealed with the seal of the living God, but they have to go through some tribulation to get there. But it's like everybody gets some kind of a seal at the end. Over.
All right. Thank you. Brother Chris.
I was just going to bring out some Old Testament scriptures in regards to show the symbolic representation of the intellectual understanding being represented by the forehead. And for the friends are familiar with them, but I'll just rattle them off real quick. Exodus 13, verse 9, Deuteronomy 6, 8, and 11, 18, and I think Revelation 13, 16, and 22, 4, and Numbers 15, 39, and Ezekiel 9, 4. I think they're all good cross-references to that concept. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Further comments? Okay, Sister Debbie.
You're muted. Debbie, you're muted.
I was wondering if Brother Chris could put those scriptures in the chat. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, for the comments. So we talked about the how the trouble, the great tribulation, the worst of which hasn't happened yet, because it tells us, Jesus told us in Matthew 24, there would be this worst trouble that ever was since there was a nation on earth. We haven't had that yet. And that he even says that it's so bad that unless the church intervened, no flesh would be saved. So that's still ahead. And we're seeing that the Lord, through his agencies depicted by the angels, are holding this trouble back until this sealing takes place of the 144,000. Sister Debbie?
I did have a question on, on a couple things in there, because I know we talked about the land and the sea and the trees last week a little bit, but the question came to my mind because he said that the messengers were holding back the winds, and there's like four messengers, four corners of the land, and four winds. That's like three things in the one verse. That's four, just a note. But it says that they were holding back so that the winds would not blow and hurt the land, the sea, and the tree. And then in the second verse, you said it only said the land and the sea. But in the third verse, the cry was to the four messengers not to hurt the land, nor the sea, nor the trees. So it implies in verse 3 that in verse 2, trees should have been there, that they could still hurt the trees. And I kind of, you know, I'm kind of not clear on that. Over.
All right. So we're going to discuss that as we go through these verses. Good question. So in verse 2, this angel that ascended from the east, last week we spent quite a bit of time pointing out and agreeing that this was Jesus returning. And this was the dawning, like the sunrise from the east, of the millennial day, the 1,000 years beginning in 1874 upon his return. And with that, he has the seal of the living God, showing that he has the authority, as it were, to have this knowledge of present truth, the divine plan of the ages, fully revealed, in the which would be used to help enlighten the spirit begotten, out of which there would be those who would take that enlightenment to the intended purpose of sealing, of having their characters crystallized, which would then allow for this sealing to be part of the 144,000. Now, some have asked, and in Brother Russell's day, some had asked, what about those who died before 1874, so to speak, or didn't have all the knowledge? And Brother Russell, he clears that up. He says that they did have the Christ-like character. They were crystallized in character. They were only responsible for what knowledge was available at their time throughout the gospel age. And so those that were faithful, upon their resurrection, they will receive the fullness of knowledge and intellectual understanding to complement their crystallized characters. And I think we can all agree that all of the 144,000 at some point in time, if we're faithful and we're resurrected, we'll learn something we didn't know. So this would even be true for those who live after 1874. No one of us knows it all perfectly and correctly. But we all know enough, once we're spirit begotten, to, that we are to be faithful to, that truth, and to allow that truth to help us to develop the right character. That's one of the things we've learned about the divine plan in our study of Revelation, the fourth chapter and the fifth chapter. We learn that the divine plan reveals God's character attributes and how they work together. So this then helps us to know how to develop a right character similar to God's and Jesus by understanding what God does and doesn't do. So, of course, the whole book of his word is all instructive for us, but it was very informative for us in the revelation to see what God had revealed about himself, so we would then know what we're to imitate in our being developed with this knowledge. Any comments on that? So then as we pass along here in verse 2, we come down. There's a loud voice. He cries with a loud voice to the four angels, to whom it was given to hurt. In other words, they could release the winds. The winds would be doing the destruction, but the angels were holding them. So the angel shows that we talked about it. The four represents, as it were, the four cardinal points of earth. So it was a worldwide control over world events and the fallen angels and Satan, so that they cannot continue the destruction of the earth until society, if you will, they could not continue that destruction until 144,000 were sealed. Then the four angels would release them. The winds would blow, creating this great whirlwind, and then would come about this great time of trouble in this very chapter called the Great Tribulation. So the 144,000 are spared that tribulation. Just for me to be a little more clear on that, in Revelation 7 and verse 13, one of the elders answered, saying to me, what are those that are arrayed in white robes, and whence came they? And I said unto him, sir, thou knowest. He said unto me, these are they which came out of great tribulation, having washed their robes. And we know this is a great company. So 144,000 are all sealed before this great tribulation. That's the great tribulation is when the four winds are let loose to blow. So this holding is holding the great tribulation back. That's just another way of saying that. So if we're curious what the four winds are, they develop, when they're let loose, they develop this great tribulation on the earth. Okay. So then, when we get back to this, our Lord Jesus has this authority to express this, this holding power, and the winds, when let loose, would hurt the earth and the sea. My humble opinion is that they don't hurt the trees in the Great Tribulation, because the trees represent, I like to view it as the 144,000. I know trees represent the righteous, and some might like it that it represents all the spirit begotten, including the great company, and that's fine. That's a good view. Verse 3, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees. And the earth is organized society under restraint. The sea is the restless masses of people, unrestrained. That is a very fitting picture of the Lord's great army in one sense. And the trees could be the righteous. I like it as 144,000. In this setting, others would like it as all the spirit begotten. And maybe some would like it, to enlarge upon that. I'm going to allow comments in a second on that. Saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants. And so in my mind, because the trees were left out in verse 2, I like it. As I say, I think the 144,000 are delivered before the tribulation. But if you don't like that, if you think that's just an omission that the trees are included to be hurt, you would have the righteous being hurt. And some would say, well, see, the righteous here is going to include the great company, and they go through the great tribulation. So they're hurt by that. So there is that view, and that makes sense too. So with all of that now, we'll allow for comments. Sister Debbie.
So maybe we can look at it as a time thing, like you were saying. They could hurt the land, the sea, and the trees, you know, which could be the 144,000. And the Lord said not to do that, but when it does come time to do that, all that's left is the land and the sea for them to injure. So they could injure all of them, but at the time that they're let loose, there's nothing left but the land and the sea. Is that kind of how to look at it? Over.
That can be, yeah. Further comments. Oh, then.
Brother Rick, I was just thinking how this forehead sealing and the holding back of these four winds, the fallen angels, really, as brought out in our Friday study, goes along well with what God is providing us right now. First we saw in the work of the harvest that after the gospel age had progressed to the harvest, it was a time to separate the wheat from the tares. And then there's a further separation of the sanctuary class, and that's pictured by the two parables, the wise and foolish virgins, and then the wedding garment test. So this sealing in the foreheads, as being brought out, is with this knowledge necessary, this intellectual knowledge of the truth, the harvest message. And that harvest message, those who are faithful will apply that and will develop the character that will give them the strength, the faith to stand in this evil day. And so these ones will be spared the greatest part of the trouble that will come upon the earth and the sea. So it's just, we appreciate how all the studies that we have are focusing in on the great blessing that God has provided for us. We have what's necessary that we will be able to stand as the days progress and the troubles increase. Over.
Okay, thank you, Brother Dan. Sister Debbie.
Just another quick question. When it says that the four winds of the land, and then you have the picture of Elijah when he was taken up in the whirlwind, how does that relate to these four winds? Does it? Over.
I don't think it does. I think it's a totally separate picture. The reason why is that the picture of Elijah is a picture of the little flock being taken home through persecution. The persecution comes at the hands of church and state. Church and state shows a government still in control. This loosing of these four winds is the destruction of government. It's the destruction of society. This would take place after the little flock has been taken up. This would be a whirlwind creating the great tribulation that the great company passes through. We notice that in the Elijah picture of Second Kings 2, the Elijah picture is that Elisha, the great company, avoids the fiery chariot and is not taken up to heaven in a whirlwind like the Elijah little flock is. So clearly, there's a distinction between the time setting of the Elijah-Elisha picture and the whirlwind that takes Elijah up that Elisha avoids versus this four winds being loosed that creates a whirlwind that the great tribulation that the great company actually does go through. Okay, Sister Cindy.
Does that mean that the great company, they see the opportunity to give the final witness, but they're scared and then they don't? Is that what you're saying?
For some, they'll see the final witness opportunity and they'll not enter in. To others, they'll still be in the nominal systems and they're not awake to their opportunities. Bottom line is, they fail on that test of under persecution. Sister Debbie.
So what you're saying is that these four winds not only take out the great company, but they take out the church and state systems as well.
They take out the nominal church and state government as well. They will lead to that, yes. Barkas.
Is the fact that Elisha smites the Jordan when he crosses back over it, which is a judgment message. That's what the Jordan represents. And that's what brings the tribulation upon them. So that's kind of part of this releasing of the four winds, I think, when you put that whole picture together. They do have an opportunity to give that final message that the mantle that Elijah passes down to Elisha when he's taken up. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
One more question. Is that the great earthquake in the middle of these four winds? Over.
The great earthquake, the greatest earthquake that ever was in Revelation 16 occurs during the, as a result of the seventh last plague being poured out. That does destroy the great city of Babylon. So that does begin the tearing down. But an earthquake is a little different from the four winds being let loose. The earthquake picture is a social revolution. This social revolution is the Lord's great army, which we think are the burned, bundled tares, now realizing that they have been duped by the churches, nominal churches, rise up and tear down those churches. That's the earthquake, those church systems. That is a picture of, that's what the French Revolution pictures. The people tearing down the papacy and the aristocracy of France. That's a 1/10 of the city falling. The other 9/10 of the city falling is depicted by the greatest earthquake that ever was. And so that's the destruction of the nominal system as an earthquake. But that earthquake turns into fire. It's followed by the fire of anarchy because there's no government to come up in place of that church and state that's taken down. See, in the French Revolution, a new government came up, Napoleon Bonaparte. So there was not a fire after that earthquake, but there's a fire after this earthquake. No mountains were found, no governments. All the hills fled away. There was no republics of that great earthquake. So what happens when you don't have government? It turns into the fire of anarchy, every man's hand against his neighbor. That fire of anarchy, we think, would depict the same as these four winds being totally let loose, which create that great tribulation, the greatest tribulation that ever was, and that time of trouble, which no flesh would survive unless the church intervene that the great company passes through. So I'll throw in one more verse on that. It's two. One is in Matthew 24, which you're so familiar with. The other one is Jeremiah 8. Jesus says, pray that your flight not be in the winter. And in Jeremiah 8, it tells us that the great company says, the summer is past and we are not saved. So summer is followed by winter in the scriptures. So the summer is the harvest of the little flock, the wheat class. Then what follows is the winter of trouble, which is this great tribulation, which is the fire of anarchy, which is the four winds being let loose. So we're lining up our pictures a little bit, and they can each teach us something. One is there's a limited trouble that comes upon the little flock. That's true. There's persecution, and there's pictures for that. The great company avoid that by and large. But then after the little flock is gone, there's this massive worst trouble that ever has been that the great company must pass through. But the little flock is spared. Okay, Brother Chris, Sister Debbie.
I hadn't thought of it before, so I haven't put a lot of thought into this. But do you think there's a connection or an application to Matthew 27 verses 50 through 53, where when Jesus had yielded up the ghost, the veil of the temple was rent in two, and then the earth did quake and the rocks rent, with the complete, that was Jesus, but his body members when they cross over the veil, and now the earth has lost its salt, as it were. An earthquake, could we make an application or a cross-reference to that? Did a friend think? Over.
All right. That's very interesting. I haven't thought of it along that line, and that very well might be a picture. Very, very interesting. We'll have to cogitate on that. Before I call on Sister Debbie, is there any comment on that particular point Brother Chris is making? Well, let's think on that, Brother Chris. That's good. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
Well, my question, again, I got to kind of maybe say it a different way. Where in time is the relationship between this great earthquake that is supposed to tear down Babylon and the civil governments in relation to the four winds that is also supposed to tear down the nominal church and the governments? Is the earthquake happening first and then the four winds are loosed? Or are the four winds loosed and the earthquake happens in the middle of this, technically, you know, during this four winds? I mean, or is the earthquake the same as the four winds? Over.
And maybe your latter comment, I don't know that I'd be so super definitive on it. I personally generally think that the greatest earthquake that ever was starts with the as a result of the seven last plagues being poured out and the Lord's great army being fully developed, including the burned bundled tares who no longer have any restraint because they are no longer under the nominal church influence because they reject it. They see it was wrong. So I would begin that earthquake. But I could easily see someone thinking that that's the four winds being released right then and there, that that's possible. I would generally think, though, that I personally would link the four winds being fully let loose with the fire of anarchy, which follows after that great earthquake. But that's, you know, we don't want to split hairs unnecessarily. Let each be convinced in their own mind how they like to line it up. But I think we're all agreed that there's going to be this tremendous trouble after the little flock is gone that the great company must pass through. All right. Brother Mark Candle.
I'd like to go back to your thought on the trees. You were saying that you favored the idea that the trees were the church still in the flesh. Is that right?
Yeah, in this setting, yeah.
Okay. And I like that thought because the reason you don't see the trees anymore is because they've been sealed in their forehead. And therefore, that aspect isn't there to be affected by anything. Is that your thought too?
Yeah, that's what I favor. Yeah.
Okay. And then when we go to Revelation 22, where it talks about this river of life with the trees on the side, and that leaves are for the healing of the nations, are those trees there? Well, if it's trees, it's not going to be the church this side the veil, but would it be like God's representatives on earth? Or is it still a picture of the church?
Okay, we'll take comments on that. Good question. Brother Dan.
Well, don't really have a definitive answer, but what comes to my mind is leaves represent professions, so the leaves of profession or the truth is what will heal the nations, heal the world of mankind as they come to know the truth, God's God's plan, God's character, what his expectations are for them, they will be restored. It'll be a process, but those leaves from the trees will be the truth, the righteousness of God, and the characteristics necessary for man to attain unto life eternal. Over.
All right. Thank you. Berkus?
Well, most of the friends are familiar with that chapter 22, verse 2, where we get a numerical picture from the fact that in the midst of the street of it, on either side of the river, there was the tree of life. And we know that, like in Genesis, this is a grove or trees, it's plural, and which bear 12 manner of fruit and yield her fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nation. So we get 12 manners of fruit, and there's 12 months to the year, so that's 12 times 12. Which is 144 during Christ's reign of 1,000 years. And so that gives us a grand total of 144,000. So it kind of points to the church in its entirety, head and body. Over.
Okay, very good. And further comments, Ruth.
Along that line, it seems to me like the tree in Revelation 22, the tree of life, which bear all these different fruits, 144,000, would be a picture of the second Eve, that she would become with Christ, the life, part of the life giver for the future. Over.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Brother Norm and then Brother Mark.
I like the scripture in Psalm 1. I know we're all familiar with it, but it seems to be a great connection with the streams of rivers, streams that we're talking about. And, you know, one might look at this and just say it's just someone, you know, the opposite of the wicked. But we think it's more than that. It's the consecrated, not just a person, that meets this criteria. It would be the spirit begotten consecrated in my mind. And it says, he is like a tree. I'm skipping verse first, second, third. I'm going right to the third verse. Psalm 1 verse 3. He is like a tree planted by streams of water. That seems right in harmony with Revelation 22, which yields its fruit in season, where we're just talking about the 12 manners of fruit, and whose leaf does not wither, whatever he does prospers. And so it makes that distinction between the unconsecrated, and nothing prospers spiritually for the unconsecrated. But I think that's a real good picture to support the idea that these trees are referring to the bride class.
All right, good. Thank you, Brother Norm. We appreciate that. Thank you. Brother Mark Candle.
Well, I was thinking that if the trees represent the church in the flesh, that the experiences of the church in the flesh, we become sympathetic high priests. It is the fruit of those experiences that help healing the nations. That it doesn't necessarily mean that the church in the future is on the earth, but it's reflecting back the idea that experiences that the church is going through now will have a benefit in the kingdom to heal the nations. That's just a passing thought. Over.
Okay, good. So there could be the aspect that the fruit can represent the benefit of what the little flock has learned through their experiences while in the flesh. Or one might say that that's what the leaves are. They're the healing portion. And quite often it's true. There's certain leaves that are beneficial medicinally, but it, that might be the aspect. And the fruitage might be restored mankind who are benefited from the leaves of these trees, which is kind of a interesting thought. I had a note from somewhere that if you square the 144,000 square, you come up with 20,736,000,000. 20,736,000,000. And that's close to a number Brother Russell gives in question book, page 438 for restored mankind. It's kind of interesting. It's not being hard and fast on that by any means.
I think it's in the first volume too, where he gives two estimates, one of 20 billion and one of 50 billion. Okay. But that could be where he gets the 20 billion from.
That's interesting. All right, good. Thank you. Brother Chris?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you just already said it, though, that the leaves are the professions of the saints. And then, of course, we would give that some validity with the Lord going to the fig tree covered in leaves, expecting to find fruit and finding none. And so he cursed it because those leaves are all the great profession of the Jews at the time, that they were Abraham's son and they were the God's chosen. And the Lord wanted to see some fruitage during the Jewish harvest. And I was like, yeah, I'm starving to death here. Over.
Okay, very good. Yeah. So we as usual, we glean little lessons throughout all of our Bible studies that we can then incorporate to help us try to figure out some of these other more symbolic areas. And not being hard and fast, but reasonable suggestions. So a verse and a picture that in my mind demonstrate that the little flock escapes that greatest time of trouble. One is we mentioned, actually, that's three. In Matthew 24, we mentioned that Jesus said, pray that your flight be not in the winter. So the little flock would have been gone during the summer of harvest. The great company has to go through the winter. But in Luke 21:36, you'll remember this. We talked about it our last study. And that was that that you might be accounted worthy to escape the trouble coming. And that's a depiction of a hope held out for the little flock to be rightly developed and zealous now in this summer of favor before the worst trouble comes. Okay. And then there was a picture of Jesus carrying his cross that you might remember that as Jesus was carrying the cross, women were weeping for him and he told them, weep not for me, but for yourselves. If they're doing this, in other words, persecuting him during a green tree. Now green tree shows favor. What will they do in the dry, showing a drought of God's favor? So Jesus he knew and he had prophesied, but he knew the coming trouble of the destruction of Jerusalem in a mere 33 years when the Romans would destroy Jerusalem and the temple, that would be a more horrible time because they were going through their problems as a punishment. Even though Jesus was going to his crucifixion, having already been scourged, horribly, horrible situation, yet he knew he was doing it for the right reason. So to his mind, he was saying that it was going to be worse for them than it even was for him, which is pretty remarkable. That, as a side note, I can't hardly think of a better example of what having the knowledge of God's permission of evil in the church, why we have to pass through the difficulties like Jesus did. What a wonderful indicator that was Jesus's understanding of the facts, that what he was suffering so horrible was for the right reason, was far superior than horrible suffering for the wrong reason. Okay. Like Paul says, you know, our light affliction is no comparison to the glory to follow, the eternal glory to follow. So Okay. Any other comments on this discussion so far? It's been pretty wide ranging. Ruth?
Well, just in regards to the timing, I just wanted to read in Revelation 16. You mind if I read there?
No. Mm-mm.
Revelation 16, 17, and 18. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven, saying, "It is done." And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. So it is done, I think, pictures that the church is complete, and then the earthquake. So it kind of fits into our timing. The trees are gone, so that's why they're not hurt, because the church is complete, over.
Yep, very good. Makes sense to me. Another one to add to the list. All right, good. Thank you. Any other comments? So going back to our Revelation 7 and verse 3, I'll just move us along a little bit here. Hurt not the earth, society under restraint, the sea, the irreligious masses of the restless mankind, not under restraint, which being part of the Lord's great army, nor the trees, which in this case, we're singularing it down to the 144,000, but reasonable minds can differ. They can make it a broader righteous class. Till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And so the servants of God here, it's specifically mentioned to be the 144,000 in our verse 4. And now we've already expressed ourselves on that ceiling, to our mind that hasn't been completed yet. Some brethren feel that there are replacement ceilings. We want to touch on that. That's not my humble opinion. But some feel that 144,000 were sealed back in, some make it, 1914. Some others might have other dates. And they feel, though, that you can lose this ceiling here in this verse. You can lose it, and that a replacement could come in and they would receive this ceiling. But, we differ with that. We think that because it says 144,000 will be sealed, and that these winds are held in check, it doesn't appeal to our mind to think that these winds were loosed and that all were sealed in the past. The winds are now blowing, and the replacement ceiling's continuing for some reason. Because then in the future, let's say when these the seals are all complete, what now is going to happen different from what you've already started? I'm not quite sure. But I just want to say that because in some of the studies, some think that, and maybe some here, I'm not sure. But we just feel that it's pretty clear. And for those who attend the Friday night study, our reading in the third volume, that demonstrated the same lesson. Now, Brother Russell was very clear that the plagues are not poured out, nor are the winds loosed until all 144,000 have been separated out of Babylon and sealed. Then the destruction of Babylon takes place, the complete destruction. And so he was pretty clear in the third volume and several places. So I'll just allow, is there any other comment on that, Sister Cindy?
Oh, when I first consecrated and I came across the scriptures in Ezekiel where they're talking about Satan, one of the things that they bring out is you were sealed. And I was stumbled by that because I thought, well, no, wait a minute, we're supposed to be sealed. So how can we be sealed? And he was sealed and he fell. So I'm not sure if that's what the brethren that believe that, if they tie that in or not, but that was one of the things that stumbled me. So just throw that out there.
Okay, thank you. Brother Michael. Did I lose you?
Sorry. Okay. Yeah, sorry. I was just trying to ask. So is the intent then in looking at this to say that the seal does not occur until the end of the race for that member of the church? Because and the reason why I sort of like subscribe to the fact that you could lose, and this is coming from Revelation 3:11, right? Where it says, let me read that in a moment. I'm coming soon. Hold on to what you have so that no one can take away your crown. Is there a reference here to that conversation? I guess it's essentially what I'm trying to ask is this. With the sealing that occurs, is it at the point where you've completed your race, or is it at the beginning of your race? Because if it's at the point where you've completed your race and you get sealed, then nobody's going to take it away from you. However, if it's at the point where it's at the beginning of your race, then you stand the risk of losing that seal, according to Revelation 3:11.
So that seal, we learn from the book of Ephesians, Paul writes that we receive a sealing when we're spirit begotten, and we can grieve that sealing, or we can damage it or mar it. Well, that's the beginning of our way. When we're spirit begotten, we receive the Holy Spirit. Right. But more than 144,000 receive that. All the spirit begotten receive that seal at the beginning. That's true. However, only 144,000 receive this seal. So we think it comes when a person has crystallized their character in Christ's likeness. So only 144,000 will have done that. That's my way I would think of it. So I would differentiate between losing the crown. A crown is apportioned to you when you are spirit begotten, when you receive this initial sealing of receiving the Spirit. But more than 144,000 get that. Let's see, Sister Debbie, Sister Cheryl.
You know, to me, you don't receive the crown till the end. That's it. A crown is set aside for you. But it doesn't mean you have it yet. It's something you're running for. That's what the race is for. If you think about the Greeks and when they ran their race, they had the laurel leaf crown, you know, that they would put on their head. It's kind of like on our cross and crown symbol. The laurel leaf is what you're running for. There's one up there. You know, it's like sort of like got your name on it, but you ain't got it yet. You know, you got to run for it. And to me, the crown is the same as the seal here in Revelation. Only 144,000 crowns are available. And you have to run the race to get that. When you're baptized and you consecrate, to me, that's like you're in line and you're starting on that race. You're running that race. You know, you're not, you haven't received that crown yet, but if the definition of the seal, like Brother Rick brought out, is the crystallization of your character, once your character is crystallized, nobody can take that away from you. You have met, you're at the mark of perfect love. You made it. You're there. Nobody can take that away from you. So to me, to, in a sense, lose a crown is not that you had the crown to begin with, but that you had the potential to get one. That's my opinion. Over.
All right, good. No, if I misspoke, then I'm sorry for that, but apportioned is the right word. Very good. Sister Cheryl.
Well, for what it's worth, with the time period of this sealing, it would seem to my mind from verses 4 through 8, that Dan isn't mentioned, which represents a second class death. A second class death. Second death class. And Ephraim is the great company, and we know they're not part of this sealing because they go through the great time of trouble. So it does show kind of a time period of where you're at in the race if you're sealed with that crystallization of character. Over.
All right, very good. So you're ratcheting us further into our context, and that's probably good to do. But I'll come back to Brother Michael. Was you have anything more on your question, Brother Michael? Did you have a thought on that further? Okay, we're good. All right, so we're going to move into moving forward then. So let's see here. Brother Adi, can you read for us verses 4 through 8, please?
Then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed, and from the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. And from the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000. And my only comment here is a lot of in the nominal Christian churches believe these 144,000 are actually Jewish people. And so when they hear that there's only 144,000 that make up the church, they roll their eyes and they don't understand this, these scriptures as being symbolic. Over.
Yes, you're exactly right. They make it 144,000 Jews who are converted during the millennium. they give it a purpose. Very good. All right, not symbolic at all. Sister Alice, could you read for us in the book of Romans? I'm going to have us read Romans 2, verse 29, please.
Romans 2.
29.
I'm getting there. But he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God.
So, Sister Alice, how would you take this verse and give it an application to what we're talking about in our Revelation 7 verses?
Well, the circumcision is not the one performed by the law, the Jewish law, but it's of the heart. And these are spiritual Israelites, not the natural Israelites of the natural tribes. So it would fit this revelation because these are spiritual tribes, not the Orthodox natural Israelites.
Okay, very good. Very good. Right on. Any other comments here on this Revelation 2 verse? So we see the power of Paul's presentation. It gives us authority for spiritual Israelites.
You mean the Romans 2?
Yes, what did I say?
You said Revelation 2.
Thank you very much. Romans 2 verse 29 gives us, the Apostle Paul gives us authority for thinking of spiritual Israelites. Sister Gina and Brother Mark, one of you, could you read Romans 9 and verse 6, please? Romans 9, 6.
Go ahead.
But it is not as though the word of God hath come to naught, for they are not all Israel that are of Israel.
Now, as strange as that verse is, Sister Gina, what is it telling us in part?
Is it talking about, like what Sister Alice just said, Israel, not the natural Jews, Israelites, but the nominal, but us, I guess, the church.
Okay. All right. So just because you're born after the flesh an Israelite doesn't mean that you are the true Israel that God is interested in.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Okay, good. Anyone else on this verse? Brother Dan.
And I think Jesus identified the true Israelite as an Israelite indeed, one who had a proper heart in seeking after and doing the will of God. Over.
Yes, if I remember right, that was when he spotted, was it Nathan? If I got the right name. Nathaniel. Yeah, that's John 1 and verse 46, if you want to read that, Brother Dan. John 1, 46 and 47.
All right. John 1:46 and 47. And Nathanael said unto him, Can there be any good thing? Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip saith unto him, Come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and saith unto him, Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile. So without hypocrisy, he had a right heart condition, and the Lord knew that. He was praying that he would know the truth concerning the Messiah.
Over. All right. Very good. Thank you. Any other comments on this angle, spiritual Israelites? I think we're all pretty familiar with that and from past studies, and that fits well. Brother Mark Candle.
I've been wondering about this replacement idea, which I have a hard time with. But at the time of our Lord's first advent, when he arrived in the city and he cast off the nation of Israel, at that time, the opportunity to be one of his followers was exclusive to the Jews. It did not go to anywhere else. But say there were 50,000 that were Jewish that accepted Jesus. That mean the balance of the 144,000 were all failures, or that they just were never apportioned? Like, what do you do with those extras? And so it went open to the Gentiles, the next 1845 years. At the end of that period of time, find out that not all the crowns were apportioned, the 144,000. But then you extend it over into the gospel, into the harvest age. Fill up that which is behind. And there's a parable where the Lord first sends his servants out to gather guests in, and they don't come in. So they start getting strangers off the road to get them to come in. He keeps filling it up until all the guests have a seat. It's almost like 144,000 doesn't mean that there were failures in there. It's just that they didn't get 144,000 to reach that standard of being sealed. And so you have the extension into the harvest, fill up what was left. I don't see a person having attained a crown and then losing the crown after they've died. What a disappointment that would be. But rather that the crown was just not portioned until later on, until someone could fit qualifications. And, that's all. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Mark. All right. We've had a good airing on that. So I trust that you brethren have all written down on a piece of paper, or for those who like to do it electronically, you've got it on your side margin somehow, all these names of these 12 tribes, because that becomes important. So, Sister Cheryl has brought to our attention the lesson that is generally understood, that the tribe of Dan and the tribe of Ephraim are not in this list. And she pointed out the tribe of Dan pictured second death, and the tribe of Ephraim represents the great multitude. So, Sister Cheryl, did you have a specific verses or suggested verses that might teach that lesson about Dan and Ephraim? Okay, we're going to give you first shot at it. Does anybody have verses that would specifically help us understand it that way? Well, let's start with Ephraim. Brother Mark Kinkowski, could you read for us Genesis 48 and starting in 19? Genesis 48, 19. I'm going to probably, for a little context, for those who, you know, and I we certainly don't blame anyone for this. In Genesis 48, Joseph has come to Jacob, his father, for blessings. And what we want to do is we want to just back up a little bit. And Joseph had his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So let's, Brother Mark, could you read in 13 through 13 through 20.
Will do. So 13.
You're still on mute.
Yeah, no, it's not. Okay. Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand towards Israel's left and Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. He blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and may my name live on in them, and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him, and he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, and he also will be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, with his descendants, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." He blessed them that day, saying, "By you, Israel, I will pronounce blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh.
All right, thank you. So that's our story of this background. But in our verse 19, Brother Mark, what do you pick out about Ephraim being highlighted?
That he will get the greater blessings.
And what happens to him? What does it reference him as?
The seed becomes a multitude of the nations.
Yes.
That's right. So that's a lot of people. And that's why the brethren think that Ephraim represents the great multitude in Revelation 7. They're missing being part of the 144,000. So there's your verse on that. Does anyone have a comment on that? Okay. Does anyone have a verse for Dan? Possibly symbolizing the second death class here. Ruth.
Well, I have one and then I have another, but I don't have the reference. The first one is in Genesis 49, 17.
You do 16 and 17, please.
Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path, that biteth the horse heels so that his rider shall fall backward. Well, that's not much of a blessing from your grandfather or father. So the rider shall fall backward. In other words, he'll die.
Okay. So a horse represents what, Ruth?
Doctrine.
And a rider of a horse?
Those that follow that doctrine.
Okay, so if you're riding a doctrine and suddenly, you know, you're supporting a doctrine and believing a doctrine, and yet suddenly you're bit by this snake and you fall backwards, what does that seem to suggest?
That you're gone, that you die, and then that's it. Doesn't seem like there's any redeeming value.
Okay, so that seems to be the distinction here, and how aptly fit. Dan was one of the first to commit idolatry in Israel, being a northernmost tribe, and that led to problems. That led to false understanding, and it led people away from God. So that's a well fitting of the second death class. Okay, Sister Cheryl.
Well, I'm going to just throw one out there. I don't know if it really represents it well or not, but I have Amos 8:14.
Amos 8:14, all right.
Might be a long shot. They that swear by the sin of Samaria and say, thy God, O Dan, liveth, and the manor of Beersheba liveth, even they shall fall and never rise up again.
Okay.
Just seeing the association with the name that it's, they're going to fall and never rise again.
Okay.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it. Thank you. Brother Chris.
I have Hosea chapter 4, verses 17 through 19.
Okay.
Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Their drink is sour. They have committed whoredom continually. Her rulers with shame do love. Give ye. The wind hath bound her up in her wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. So a little bit obscure, but it doesn't shed a good light on them.
Right. Right. Good. Thank you. Ruth.
Also, the other one I was thinking of is in 1 Kings 12,
okay.
28 to 31. Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Bethel and the other put he in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even unto Dan. And he made a house of high places and made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. So Dan became the seat of idolatry.
Yes. Okay. Very good. All right. Appreciate that. Sister Molly.
I had a question about Ephraim. I'm just confused. If Ephraim was given the right hand blessing, why do we see Manasseh listed in the 144,000 and not Ephraim? Is it just Ephraim is greater in number related to the great company? I feel like I'm missing something. Over.
That's true. And now that leads us to our closing comment because we're running out of time. Our list in Revelation 7 is a unique list to itself with its symbolic lessons. The Revelation 7 list of these 12 tribes is unique to itself. If you were to look in, for example, if you were to look at Ezekiel, the 40, let me get it right for you. If you were to look in Ezekiel, the 48th chapter, you would read of the tribes of Israel and their land divisions. And in those land divisions, Dan is included, Manasseh is included, and Ephraim is included in the land divisions. That's a good thing for restored mankind, which is, I'm saying this quick, we'll come back the next week. This, if you haven't thought along these lines, you can cogitate on it. But if you can go through and you can make your list out of Ezekiel 48, you can see a list of the 12 land divisions for the 12 tribes. Dan, Manasseh, Ephraim are included there. In Ezekiel 48, you can make a list for the gates to the city, 12 gates to the city. Dan is included there. And Ephraim is not, and Manasseh is not. So when you look at the tabernacle, Dan and Ephraim as tribes are in association with the 12 tribes around the tabernacle. But I'm liking the Ezekiel correspondences to teach us that we're not to think that Dan and Ephraim always and in all pictures denote the second death class and the great company class. It's unique to our Revelation 7. And what we'll say is that is symbolic of the spiritual Israelites. So the lesson regarding spiritual Israel in Revelation 7 has this unique picture about Dan and Ephraim as failures. But in other settings, with restored mankind, they're not necessarily depicted as failure. They're included. So we'll have to leave it there at this point. We're out of time. We'll pick up next week. We'll go back through this. But if you get the opportunity to look at those places and make yourself some notes, it would be refreshing, because in our Wednesday night study of Ezekiel, you know, some months from now, we'll be getting to these chapters. And it's just another way of helping make ourselves acquainted with it. All right, got to close here. So, Lord willing, we'll come back to our Revelation 7, our verses 4 through 8. So, with that, then.